Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, and this is Insight is Capital. Most investors right now seem to be in two camps. Either this is another late cycle tech surge driven by AI hype, or we're replaying 1999 just with better branding. CapEx is surging. AI dominates the headlines. Valuations do feel stretched. So the instinct is defensive. Wait for the pullback, avoid the crowd. But what if the real risk isn't owning too much innovation? What if it's underestimating a structural acceleration? ARK Invest calls this moment the Great Acceleration. Their thesis is that AI isn't just another theme. It's accelerating five major platforms at once: artificial intelligence, public blockchains, robotics, energy storage, and multiomics. Not a sector rally, a potential system-level shift. If this is just a CapEx boom, portfolios will tend to lean defensive. But if it's a productivity regime change, portfolios built for the last decade may be misaligned for the next one. Joining me today is Dan White, Associate Portfolio Manager at ARK Invest, where he plays an instrumental role in translating disruptive innovation research into portfolio strategy. Let's jump in.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Dan, welcome to the show. It is so great to have you.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here. It's always great to catch up.
It's very timely. I mean, we've had a lot of activity occur in the last month. SaaSpocalypse, the launch of Claude Code, and then Altruist disrupting the fintech sector, and Claude Code disrupting the entire SaaS sector. February, of course, has proven to be sort of a recalibration. So I'm wondering, before we jump into that, because I want to get your take on it, but maybe, Dan, first you can tell us a little bit about your role at ARK.
Yeah, of course. So yeah, you said SaaSpocalypse. It's crazy to think that's only been a few weeks. It feels like a lifetime here, a year. But so Dan White here. My role at ARK is an associate portfolio manager. I sit kind of horizontally across the teams in more of a generalist function, working directly with Kathy Wood. A lot of my day-to-day is really collaborating with Kathy, trading, and our various directors of research and analyst teams, where they're more verticalized special. So think like Frank Downing. He is our director of research for cloud and AI. I know we'll touch on a lot today. A lot of this is his very high quality research. It's working with Frank, it's working with Kathy, and it's bringing all of that together into a portfolio that we think is best aligned to give clients a sleeve and allocation to exponential growth opportunities within innovation.
Thanks for sharing that, Dan. So back to sort of my opening remarks, it's been quite a start to 2026. We saw some very high-profile AI announcements, the Anthropic Claude Code announcement, and Altruist / Hazel, which had a very sort of disruptive impact and challenged, because it challenges the core business models in SaaS and fintech. For starters, I mean, that's been a lot of the source of the volatility and activity at the beginning of February. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's a timely question and good question. That's SaaSpocalypse one. I think a lot of it, when you think kind of to the background here, Claude Code seems to be what sparked it. And it feels like to us, the market is now waking up to the potentials of AI. And it's in this moment of time where it's sort of, sell first, ask questions later type of mentality. And from our point of view, we've been doing this research since 2014 at the founding of the firm. We tend to focus on these lesser known, very innovative names that may not be a household name today, but we think become the household name over the next business cycle. You've seen some of that with like OpenAI and ChatGPT, Anthropics, Claude, which is like kind of the play on Claude is Claude Code. It's now Open Claude. And, Peter actually, who developed it, is now with OpenAI, which we think was a a huge strategic miss by Anthropic. So all of that that's kind of played out, and I should mention that those are exposures in our venture fund. Like, we've been doing research on these. We've had access to them. So we kind of expect this. And we think you're going to start to see a lot of this translate into public space as well. If you just look at Palantir, that's one that is bringing these LLM capabilities into an enterprise. And you've seen it's growing 130% year over year in the U.S. commercial unit, accelerating, I think, from the prior quarters in the 120s, all while expanding its operating margins. That's how powerful AI can be.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are staggering in some cases. It differs greatly from, you know, the sort of ghost of 1999, you know, where investors are sort of looking at this current route in the market that we've seen in February and thinking, you know, is that where we are right now? I mean, a common view right now is that AI looks a lot like late cycle, looks a lot like late cycle tech exuberance, heavy CapEx, dominant platform companies, you know, massive narrative energy. I recall, you know, the early 2000s when, you know, all that fiber optic cable build out that was happening, you know, with Global Crossing and WorldCom, you know, putting undersea fiber optic cable that just ended up being dark for a decade, is what people probably fear to some degree when they think about the infrastructure that's set to be built out, the CapEx, you know, $600 billion of CapEx planned for this year alone. When you hear that comparison to 99, where do you think it's fair and where, if at all, and where does it completely miss what's happening structurally?
It's a great question, and one that we've received in various forms. So I'll try to answer both what's fair and what we're kind of seeing. So starting with what's fair, you know, this is a new AI specifically. This is really a new feeling technology. ChatGPT was just a few years ago, and it is scaling rapidly. Everyone kind of has a clear understanding and feeling of how this can affect the world and how it will change the world, similar to technology back in the day. So you have this new technology. And then when you look on the CapEx side and we look at it relative to GDP, if you compare it to 1999 and you look at the IT and comm services sector, CapEx is at a similar level as a percentage of GDP today as it was then. And then on top of that, you have a market concentration. Back then, you had a lot of players, heavy top heavy index, and today you have a similar thing. So I think that's where it's fair to draw similar comparisons. Now, where it's different, I'll say it's sort of a few places here. It is the usage uptake. You talked about how that, you know, the cables were dark for a long time. So usage uptake, the revenues that are happening today, the valuation, and then just generally market fear. So on the usage side, we look at this. If you look at active users of these chatbots, they're at 1.2, 1.3 billion today. That's about 20% of smartphone users. And if you compare that to internet users as a percentage of PC users, that crossed the 20% line in 1996. So you're seeing kind of an uptake there, but you're seeing the speed of uptake from AI happening twice as fast as smartphones. And so that speed is a really interesting part of just how fast users are onboarding here. And so it's one, it's the users. Two, it's just how much time are they spending? The average user has about an hour a week engaging with a chatbot. Whereas in the internet, in the mid-90s, that 96 kind of time period, it's only about half an hour a week. And so today's internet, it's about 10 hours a week. So that's a sevenfold increase in that time. And if you kind of translate that to the AI chatbots, right, an hour a week, sevenfold, it's an hour a day is what it would translate to. And if you put that across 5 billion users using that same uptake speed, which is faster than the internet, you're at about a little off, but I think it's around 1.8 or maybe 2 trillion hours per year. And YouTube does about 1 trillion hours per year. So you have a significant amount of, right, use on this. That's one of, I love YouTube. It's one of the most heavily used apps. And, but on top of that, and right, that's also a connection. Maybe you could look at the internet and just say, oh, it's eyeballs. But the next step forward here is revenue and valuation.
Right.
So revenue side, just OpenAI and Anthropic, just those two. They're already doing $40 billion in ARR. And if you take out Anthropic, if you just look at Anthropic, they've grown at the end of last year to the middle of February this year. So just a month and a half, call it 2 months type of update. They've grown from $9 billion to $14 billion. And a part of that a lot is the Claude Code has doubled in 1.5 months. It's off a smaller base, I get it. But you can see just how fast that these can grow revenue because of what they're offering end users, right? If you can just save yourself a few hours of work a week or even, you know, half an hour, you can pay for that subscription right away. It's crazy not to. And I mentioned Palantir. That's another example of just massive revenue coming into this space with expanding margins. And so when we step back and we look at the valuation, which is always the question we'll get, PE ratios of those major tech companies in the early kind of, if you take the top end of that NASDAQ, it was about at 100 times. And today, if you take that top end where we are, it's about 40 times. So it's really headline grabbing to say, there's this, you know, there's a massive market cap size, but the valuations, they're not exuberant. And finally, I mentioned fear too of just the difference here. And I think it's important of just the market psychology here. Everyone's scared, terrified, you know, in some cases that this is a bubble. And so as more and more people say this and there's max fear that there's a bubble, you're probably not in a bubble if everyone's saying it. And that's when, you know, that's a good thing, right? That's where we like to invest. If everyone starts saying like these companies can do no wrong, they're going up into the right forever, there's no issues, valuations don't matter, that's concerning. That's what we don't want to see. Kathy gives an example, and perhaps you remember the example of Jeff Bezos in the latter years of the bubble. He, during an earnings call or during a presentation, he said that, you know, next year we're going to spend even more money and more money, and we're going to lose even more money, but it'll be great down the road. And the stock went crazy. Kathy was, you know, she was giving us this story. The market loved it. They ate it up. That's what they wanted to hear. You just look to the last few weeks, you know, as these hyperscalers release their earnings and increase CapEx, they're sold off as they invest in themselves. But what we're seeing is these GPUs, unlike fiber back then, these GPUs are not sitting idle. We already don't have enough supply for the demand we want.
That's right. They're all lit.
We need way more of these GPUs in this CapEx build.
Well, I think as people start, you know, as more and more people use AI chatbots like Claude and ChatGPT, more and more, they realize more and more how useful it is, you know, how much utility it has to them. In you know, whether it's their work, their professional, you know, their career, their work, or their personal lives. And I think, you know, looking at the beginnings of ChatGPT, you know, it was exciting at the very beginning. And in the beginning, it was, you know, it was probably, you know, it was started on, you know, the initial skeleton of an AI, a public AI framework. But once the developers realized the rate of increase of growth, you know, the rate of growth of usage of these, you know, even the early iterations of ChatGPT, once they realized like what the uptake was, you know, the fastest uptake of an application platform in history, you know, then the worry sets in, you know, how do we scale up with that demand? You know, how do we go from, you know, 40 million users to a billion users, you know, in a very short space of time, which we're talking, you know, a couple of years that it's been, but it explains largely why the CapEx build out has reached the sort of, you know, feverish level that it looks like. And some investors, Dan, argue that hyperscaler AI spending is unsustainably front-loaded, that we're pulling demand forward. From your perspective at ARC, what evidence would tell us this is a temporary capital cycle versus the early build out of a new productivity base?
Yeah, it's a great question. The CapEx question comes up a lot, and it rightfully should. I think you're seeing, even kind of in that sentiment you were explaining earlier with these large hyperscalers and Alphabet, Amazon, I think you're seeing perhaps a shareholder turnover because of that CapEx. Most shareholders are used to these. It's just these big cash cows and share buybacks and fortified balance sheet with cash. That's what they want. We want to see this build out. This is great. These are opportunities for us. That's how we view it. And as far as where the cycle is and the productivity base to the question, I think you know where I'm going to shake out. It's on the latter side of a productivity base, but I'll go through the full question. So there's no guarantee here that CapEx is going to go up and to the right forever. And it's a great thing. You know, overbuilds happen. This is part of the AI chain though, or we've heard it said other ways. Like Frank was calling it our the token value chain. And we've heard OpenAI call it the token economy, which I think we're kind of landing towards that one. But parts of that chain are cyclical, especially on these, like the semi side. But important to remember, there's a powerful secular tailwind behind that too. So with OB3, the one big beautiful bill, you have this upfront depreciation, massive build out into data centers. That's a good thing. That's incentivizing businesses to build for the future of, you know, both themselves and capitalist, you know, opportunities here, but also just geopolitically, we need that. So the data center build right now, it's around 500. I know what they're announcing, but 500 kind of at the end of the year. That's a 2.5-fold increase from ChatGPT. By our modeling and big ideas, we expect to see that go to 1.4 trillion by 2030. And that's a necessity to have the productivity boom that our research suggests. And so an overbuild, and that kind of back to that bubbly question here, what you'll see in the way that what we're watching for, if a bubble would start to form, you have this race of supply and demand taking off together. Demand kind of flattens out. Supply continues at its same space. You get this little pocket in the middle there. That's the pop. But we're not seeing that today. And you know, we mentioned earlier, demand's far exceeding supply. And so when you look at what a lot of our modeling does to help us kind of be comfortable with this too is, it's a great example of Wright's Law, which is the center of our research. So it's Wright's Law. It's every cumulative doubling of a unit produced, there's a consistent decline in price. We like to see this. We need to see this to invest, because as that cost falls, you get exponential demand. As each decrease in cost, you get a bigger and bigger step up in demand. That's exponential. That's what we need. That's what we're going to see. So on these model side of things, if you look at a fixed performance reasoning model, over the last year, the cost of that inference is down 99%. And usually that would be when you can, you know, be concerned, maybe we overbuilt for this. But you're seeing token supply increase 25x over that same year. And so it's great Wright's Law. Costs are coming down. Demand is exponentially growing as you can find new use cases to unlock. And we hear this from the cloud providers, right? They utilization of their GPUs for quarters now, 4, 5, 6 quarters, they have more demand than they can supply. And you can very easily imagine how this demand can rapidly continue to grow, which is why we need that continuation of build. And I say that because with Cloud Code, this is kind of what it's really, I think, starting to bring to life a growing gap between this technology's capability and how the average person or the average user is using it. It's evolving faster than imaginable. We know what people say about us in the market. Many say we're far too aggressive. We've been too conservative on AI. And so the market got swept up in Claude Code and Cowork and this plugin capability. That was 6 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, and it feels like there's been an inflection point, but most people still don't know the full utilization of these features. We have people on our own research team that are discovering each day, you know, how to better use the coding capabilities of Claude, myself included. You know, we're using our Palantir system internally. And as, you know, a few of the team that on the tech side build this out more and more, I'm blown away by the capabilities.
Right.
It's saving me a lot of time. And so most people are using this as just a chatbot. You know, who won the golf major last year? Why, right? That's one that I use it for a lot. But actually driving work at a higher leverage point to like human time put in versus work put out, that's really inflecting since only December. I think if you just look at that from the demand side and you just pretend this technology never gets better, we're just stuck where we are for some crazy reason. Well, it's only a tiny, tiny, tiny single percentage amount of users that are using these LLMs to that capability.
Right.
And we're already out of GPUs today. So you can see where this needs to go.
You can see where the usage is leading to more and more experimentation and more implementation. And you can see why there's a shortage in GPUs, because people are, as you dig into that, you know, sphere of knowledge, don't know, you don't know, or you know, you don't know, you know, there's things you know that you don't know about. Once you get further into that, and then you realize there's things you didn't know about, and you start digging into that, the amount of work that's required to, you know, make that use, you can see where it's affecting, you know, it's going across the entire business ecosystem. And in your models, you talk about how AI is accelerating robotics, accelerating energy systems, blockchains, and even developments in biology. And skeptics might say that's, you know, thematic bundling. But what, in your view, makes this true technological convergence rather than parallel hype cycles? I mean, to support your great acceleration thesis.
To the parallel hype cycles here, and this technological convergence, the way we kind of, I think what's important to start with is just how we define an investment platform. So we have three criterias that we go through to make sure a technology is ready for investment. I described the first one, Wright's Law. That's cost declines opening exponential demand growth. The second one is that technology will cut across sectors and industries. And that's important because if it kind of hits a roadblock in one, well, it can still proliferate in another. So you have demand in different verticals. And then the third would be a launching pad for new innovation. You know, you can look at your phone here. Whoever thought putting a phone in your hand could lead to an entire industry where a robotics car comes and picks me up, right? It's a launching pad for these new innovations too. And you'll often hear us say when something kind of checks all three of those boxes, this investment's ready for prime time. That means the technology is ready for an investment. So that's how we're identifying these platforms. And now when you think of AI and the advancements in AI, its acceleration is accelerating the change in other technologies. That's what we want to see. That's that third launching pad part. And that's why AI is this central catalyst to many of our themes. When you step back and look at kind of the others here, I think maybe like some examples are helpful. You know, AI is moving so quickly, and just in our own world, right? You know, studies are kind of at like 1 hour a day you're saving on AI tools. So, in knowledge work jobs, and so that is going to accelerate, and that productivity will increase, and it will it'll just reimagine how you do your day to day life. And that's in the enterprise side of things. Then you go to the physical world, like robo-taxis, right? That's their advancement is independent of how much I use, you know, vibe coding in my day-to-day, right? And so that's kind of a diversification within the portfolios of technologies and differentiation. And to take it even one step further, biology, that's another, as funny as it sounds to say it's physical world, it very much is. And that is a massive wealth of data that is highly complex very quickly, especially as you get into single cell sequencing and just how much complexity you can have. Well, the advancement in drug discovery and drug in, you know, diagnostics and treatment, that's not going to affect robotaxis. That's not going to affect enterprise adoption. That's not going to affect agentic commerce. And so these themes have an underlying kind of AI booster to them, but they all have independent secular tailwinds as well. And when we find a company that can hit on multiple platforms, those are the ones that you'll see tend to have very large exposures in our portfolio, because they have, you know, in powerful optionality from these technologies and multiple inflection point capabilities.
Yeah, I you know, you just mentioned something about, you know, sort of second derivative or second order effects and third order effects that are sort of implicit, or, you know, I think it's the, you know, those are the, those effects are the, you know, where at the enterprise level, you know, there's this light bulb moment that happens where, you know, we didn't know that. And then all of a sudden there's a breakthrough. And, you know, we've seen already, I mean, even pre-chat or pre-AI, you know, we've seen a lot of these developments happen. But as, you know, as AI becomes more and more ubiquitous and more and better, the ability to come to those breakthroughs is happening faster. So I can see where you know, you at ARC are excited about those, convergence companies that intersect, that are, you know, at the intersection of two or more of these trends in technological development. I think, you know, one of the big questions is, they talk about this huge $600 billion CapEx for 26. When you see $600 billion trickling into all these other segments of technology that are not as well known, suddenly those companies have the prospect of becoming very exciting as well, right? And that's part of your thesis as well, is that there are going to be beneficiaries of this $600 billion CapEx, and identifying the key beneficiaries, the actual key end beneficiaries of that $600 billion in CapEx and beyond, to the $1.4 trillion figure that you mentioned. That's the part that's really, I imagine you've quantified it as well as you possibly can, but that's the part that leads to this great acceleration, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's for a moment invert the thesis, just so we can talk about it, air it. Right? Let's invert that. If the great acceleration is wrong, like if your thesis is wrong, what do you think it would be that would break it?
Yeah. And I'm glad you set it up of kind of what this great acceleration is. It's the early innings of AI, and like we've said a few times now, the fibers are not laid. They're used actively today to drive sort of this super cycle.
You need more.
We need more, exactly.
And it's all the picks and shovels companies, right? It's all the companies that are the service providers, the construction, the developers, the chip fab designers.
We've heard from companies that, you know, electricians to wire these data centers, we have to give them raises because we don't have enough. We need to incentivize more people out here. So when we think of like what can break this, ARC has its own thesis risk kind of metric, and I'll touch on kind of what it is really quick. It's just a way for us to battle test some of our assumptions of like where we could go wrong and try to ascribe a value and a headwind into some of our modeling. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention too, just our open research nature, where when Kathy founded the firm, one of her founding pillars was to be open, like technology open source financial research, which is at the time was crazy for anyone to think of doing
right.
that. But what that's helped us do is when we put these models out there, we go to we can publish this. We go to X. We do recordings all the time. We have a weekly brainstorming session that involves external parties that are venture capitalists, academics, founders, tech enthusiasts, kind of anyone that's in this ecosystem that wants to debate technology. And we just debate it at the high level of like what's going right, what's going wrong, where are we aggressive, where are we conservative? And so some of these things that can kind of cause these hiccups are on the macro level, just your typical economic cycles, geopolitical events, supply chain issues, which like what we saw post-COVID, regulatory hurdles, just too much bureaucracy getting in the way. And there's, you know, many more. Those tend to be kind of the highest level ones. And on the micro side of things, for example, like Tesla with robotaxis, we ascribe a large part of our future value to that autonomous network and the margin change of Tesla going from manufacturing to software-like. But the safety margin for these cars needs to improve, and regulatory stall hurdles are still in the way that we have to get through. So there's thesis risks kind of both top-down and bottom-up for all of our companies. And so for the great acceleration as the high-level theme in particular, you touched on it, so much is indexed to this compute capacity. In a material slowdown there would have a chain of effects downstream. Compute is certainly the concern. And if you think like there's a few ways that wouldn't be a surprise of how this can have issues, right? If the market just decides, I don't want to invest in this stuff anymore. You've seen kind of it panic recently, right? We think you'll see revenues on the other end. So, that one we don't think is as severe. But China invading Taiwan, that would be a serious issue. Regulatory blocks of energy deployment or even building construction, especially in a midterm cycle. I think it's interesting that you've heard the likes of DeSantis and Bernie Sanders, two people who never agree on anything, talking about the affordability of data centers in their state. So, there's certainly, we take in a lot of accounts of those. All of that poses a risk. And it's because in that token economy that we've talked about, well, that scarce resource is compute, and the companies that end up owning that compute, that resource, and the ones that learn how to monetize on top of it, they're the ones who ultimately have the biggest reward. And so to end a question that's on the negative, on a positive side of things too, of why we don't think this will happen. If you think of tokens representing an AI in that sense, representing digital intelligence, well, tokens have increased 25% over the last year on the inferencing side. If you play that out as cost declines and usage picks up in general education capabilities of kind of what we've talked about today, of just showing people how to use these, if all that continues, it's really hard to imagine a world that wants to limit its intelligence. And that's why we think you'll see these regulatory hurdles be pulled down. And the current administration is doing they've been very friendly pro-business in that sense. And then on just other ones of energy deployment and construction, we think it gets there. We think China knows the risks of invading Taiwan in both ways. So, there's pulls and takes with all of these, of course.
You know, when you start to think about what could go wrong, I mean, another, just to pull on another thread for a moment before we move on, there's also a lot of talk that there might not be enough power generation, or that data centers will take too much of a toll on power generation and cause an inflationary spike in energy costs for everybody else, right? The industry seems hell-bent on building out the power capacity. You know, there's a lot of counter-arguments to the power generation question. Because we also, in Canada and in the U.S., have an overabundance of natural gas that could easily be repurposed for electricity generation. You mentioned, electricians, not enough electricians available to do the wiring. right? I mean, it goes down to like this discussion goes down to the most rudimentary aspects of the build out. It's great if you've got $600 billion this year to engage in this build out, but what if you can't get the builders? What if you can't get the people? What if you can't get enough workers to, you know, commit to these build outs? And, you know, what are the cost overruns? What are the delays? What perm exactly? Those are those red tape tie ups can also be a potential headwind to this thesis, but it doesn't stop it. It's more of a time problem than an actual implementation problem. Like it reminds me of, you know, the time problem that Tesla faced 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. Elon even go an extra step this time with how yeah. little build he thinks will happen on the planet terrestrially. He is now going to space to put his data centers because right. it's free energy, more compute, and I don't have to deal with any of the bureaucracy talking to me about affordability or anything. I'm going to put this in space.
And nonstop solar.
Yep.
Right? That's the part that's sort of underestimated about that space initiative, which is that you can be in space, there's no clouds, you can be in the sun all day long. But
that's what gives all of the large language models, they have all their strengths and weakness. Yeah. And certainly the strength for xAI is that they have first right to all of that compute that would be in space. And so that's a huge structural advantage down the road. And that's also why we think SpaceX wanted that rather than just having that fixed right. kind of margin of putting something up there. They have this exposure to the huge right tail skew of what these LLMs now can offer on that's being built on top of that data that they're creating, that compute they're creating.
That's a great example of the convergence you're talking about.
Absolutely.
All these overlapping themes that are coming together for certain companies. I want to talk about the underinvestment risk. Most portfolio risk discussions today are centered or focused on the idea of overexposure to innovation. And for good reason, technology has become a very large component of the S&P 500, and lots of people own index funds like it, which are exposed to highly valued technology companies. That is not the entire ecosystem. So maybe the problem is concentration. So that's why a lot of the discussion is centered on overexposure to innovation as a headline allocation. But what does underexposure look like? What does underexposure risk look like in a scenario where the great acceleration proves correct? How should investors think about that asymmetry?
Yeah, it's an important question and gets to kind of the root of, what innovation companies ARC looking at. So stepping first to more of the traditional side of things before ARC, traditional asset allocators, we think are in large part scared of innovation, right? It's just, and that's part, it's inherent to its nature. It's inherently volatile. Mm-hmm. And when you look to these standard risk models that have been created over the years and decades, it signals high risk. And a lot of the traditional way of doing things is being uprooted. And that's not in that type of traditional modeling. You know, I think back to my days on the fund diligence side and portfolio construction side. A standard risk metric is standard deviation. What a poor metric to measure risk, right? It's just backward-looking price. And there's pieces of it I get that get involved. But like, if you look at Ford and Tesla on that unit of risk, Ford looks way safer as an investment than Tesla. But I would argue under the hood into their actual financial statements and fundamentals, the risk is much greater for Ford than it is for Tesla. And so I think just on the overexposure side, there's a reluctancy because of the traditional models to welcome some volatility, because volatility can be opportunity. It doesn't necessarily always mean risk in that traditional sense. So ARC's point of view, that asymmetry part is, according to our research over this next business cycle, the lion's share of market value will accrue to innovation. And AI is certainly that central catalyst point that we've talked about. And if you sort of operate on that assumption that most investors are underexposed, well, ARK has been researching this stuff since its very inception, focusing on those lesser known names that we think should be in the benchmarks, as you had mentioned, those larger ones. Those will be the companies we're looking at that today might not be as known, but tomorrow, or over this cycle, I should say, become the household name. And so from an investor's end, we think the market is kind of handing people an opportunity to get in here, especially with the sell-off, Mr. Market saying, here's a discount, where it's agreeing with us. It's saying, I've woken up to the potential of AI, and I'm going to just sell everything and figure out what to do after this. Disruption's coming. And what means on the other side of disruption is exponential growth for winners. So now's the best time, in ARK's view, for active management. And I know that is biased. Consider who you're talking to, but business winners and losers will emerge at a faster rate than ever before, with those winners having exponential growth. And so it's important that while it might feel like you're overexposed, the world is only going to become more, I'm going to make up words, software-tized, right? Where more and more of this data is going to become interconnected and work together, and actionable insight draws on top of that. And so what we've seen from clients is, they use these types of strategies both for that asymmetric upside and exponential growth, but also just as a hedge. That what if I'm wrong, and wait, what if my overexposure actually is underexposure? Well, I can get a small satellite position of high octane names that I think will replace in this benchmark. And that's a good way that I can have both. I can have a little more comfort in my total portfolio of what's going on.
Core and satellite. So
exactly.
You got your core index fund, which has exposure to everything, the biggest names. And then you have your satellite exposure to something like ARK.
Yeah. And you don't want that core satellite bleeding out a lot of its capital because of a disruptive force. That satellite can both plug that and grow right. The sort of reservoir exponentially.
That's the thing. And in all the various themes that you are covering, and across all the various segments and sectors of the technology, of the tech sector, which there's so many, the drivers differ from one segment to the next. And so even within the tech sleeve, you can achieve great diversification because the volatility that occurs between the dispersion that occurs between those segments is often enough to smooth the overall ride. It may not work in times when correlations climb to one against the sell-off, but over the long term, it does provide a much smoother ride if you're well diversified across the various segments of the tech sector. Dan, I'm curious to know if you have any. I know you've shared a couple of stories, maybe some of your favorites. But do you have some favorite stories that you can share?
Sure. I'll give a few. So we moved from, I was part of the move from New York to Florida with the company.
Right.
And down here, we my wife and I purchased a Tesla. We have FSD. And we drove from our home in St. Pete, which is about a 3.5-hour drive, to my in-law's place in the Fort Lauderdale area. I touched the steering wheel maybe once. That was like mind-blowing. I hate driving. So I cannot wait for the time I can actually turn that, those several hours into useful, opportunities. You can even work during that time. It has,
right.
It's going to be one of the largest productivity changers in the world. And then I'll give you an example of just in my own, this will be a fun one. There's no real dollars tied to this one, but in the sake of just enjoying what AI can do, I'm a big golfer. I'm not good, but I went to a place to try to fix my driver. You can do all these hosel different changing settings. You hit a bunch of drivers, you change it, hit them, and then you feed it to ChatGPT or Claude with screenshots. You say, here's the data. How do I fix this? And it can dissect what I'm doing wrong and how to fix things just because it has so much information. It is incredible. I haven't gotten better, but I know what I'm doing wrong.
That's wonderful. I think the driving story, I mean, they're both, those are both great. I like the driving story in particular because I actually am the opposite. I love driving. And I mean, I don't like driving in you know, commuter traffic, but I love driving in general. But I also, at the same time, I envy the folks who commute by train because, you know, you have that hour on the train where you can do other things. You can read, you can work, you can do whatever you want, right? You don't have to have your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. But now I can see you've actually given me a clearer sense because I think I've sort of been in denial about this full self-driving business, which is that, you know, you could get in your car and you could be just like the folks on the train.
Yeah, it'd be great. I'll give you another example this morning too, actually. We, in our company every day at 8:45, we have our morning meeting update, which is like business updates. And part of what Kathy's done to try to stimulate AI adoption across the whole company, there's a sense of urgency. We research how powerful this is going to be and disruptive. We don't want to be disrupted by it. And so this morning, Nick Gruss, he's one of our director of research on the consumer side of things. He built using Claude Code a web page that shows AI wearables and the different parts of the body, where they go, what their current revenues are, their sizes, their companies, their forward-looking, everything that we kind of have in this separate space, bringing it to life in a place where data can just continue to feed in over there and his dashboard can automatically update. And I loved the framing he gave it, as he said that the productivity boost of time that I'm saving here is just an infinity symbol, because I could never do this in the past. And so that's kind of like a wow moment as well.
That's really cool, actually. It's interesting, you know, to think that, you know, you could actually replace all that work that you never could actually do in the first place with something that's remarkable. Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable insight. It has been terrific having you here, and our conversation has been eye-opening.
Thank you. I appreciate the time and the great questions. We could go on for hours about AI.
Dan, we'd love to have you back to continue the conversation. Thank you again. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.